Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 197 on how to invest in a franchise business with John Ostenson. If you're into building wealth through real estate investing, you are in the right place. My goal is to identify high caliber real estate investors and other industry service providers, invite them on the show, and then draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars or more in the business of real estate. So today's guest, John, is a consultant, investor, author, and international speaker specializing in the area of non-food franchising. Having served as the president of an Inc. 500 franchise system, and now as a multi-brand franchisee himself, John is uniquely positioned to educate others on franchising and franchise selection. In addition to serving as the CEO of FranBridge Consulting, John oversees FranBridge Capital, where he and his partners actually own and operate multiple service franchises. So today's episode is a little bit of a different avenue than we normally go, but it ties in because real estate investors like me and you rely on the next deal in order to remain profitable. I'm always hunting for the next deal. I'm sure you know the feeling. And with the tightening of the real estate market over the past 2 years and deals becoming harder to find, some real estate investors are turning to franchise business ownership. John and I discuss opportunity to get consistent cash flow by investing in these non-food franchise businesses. We also discuss John's building of a portfolio of franchise businesses, the reasons why exiting, meaning selling a franchise business, is often more profitable and much easier than exiting a business that you've constructed yourself, and why you should run from food franchise business models, normally what most people think of when you hear the word franchise. Please enjoy this conversation with John Ostenson.
All right. Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, John. How are you doing today?
Doing great. Appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, for sure. So for listeners, we're going to go in a little bit of a different direction than our usual buy apartment buildings, flip houses kind of a topic, which is exciting. I was looking forward to this show when our booking agents got together and arranged this on our schedule. Do you want to kind of give the origination story, the background, and what your business model is, John?
Yeah, absolutely. So my background, first off, is I spent most of my career in the corporate world and like so many others, had that desire to do something a little more entrepreneurial. And about 5 years ago, I stepped into a smaller private company called Shelf Genie. It's a national franchise system, and had the opportunity to serve as president, leading the home office of marketing teams, call center technology, all supporting franchise owners of our brand around the country and around Canada as well. We had about 180 locations, and services business. And that experience really opened up my eyes to the world of franchising outside of food. You know, oftentimes when people think of franchising, they think food, but there's a whole nother world that exists out there. And long story short, I ended up partnering with the founder of Shelf Genie, and we are now franchisees on the other side of the table ourselves. And we have a pool cleaning business, home cleaning business, and a carpet cleaning business. And we're looking to expand that portfolio over time. For the most part, we have good people that run those businesses for us. So I'm able to spend about 90% of my time consulting with clients, helping them find the right opportunities for investment, or in some cases to jump in and leave their day job and become full-time owner operators. But a lot of the clients I work with are real estate investors. I'd say, in fact, probably the majority. And there are certain sectors that oftentimes attract them, within franchising, whether it be home services or property services. Or they're looking for more of a real estate play that has a business component to it. And so I just love having the opportunity to walk them through the process, expose them to opportunities, help them understand the ins and outs of business ownership through franchising. And what we found is for many of them, franchising really is a great complement to what they're doing on the real estate side.
Yeah. And let's talk about that. I mean, why are they so interested? Real estate investors, we're looking for rate of return, passive income, that kind of thing. And like my first thought is I feel like, I could be totally wrong, but I feel like when I go to Subway, like sometimes it's the owner who's in there making the sandwich. And to me as a real estate investor, I'm like, man, I don't want any part of a franchise that I'm going to basically have a high paying job, right? Like we're looking for rental properties that are managed by the third party management company that spit off cash, maybe not enough as if I were actually in there doing all the work myself, but great way to put my savings to work. Right, John? It's like, right. Why is the real estate investor community the buyer right now that you seem to be doing a lot of business with?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts there. So first off, you know, Subway, you know, which is part of the food category, I do stay away from food. That is much more of an owner operator type businesses we work with, and we'll delve into the sectors in a minute. Offer the owner-operator opportunity, but they also offer what we call a semi-absentee. Now, it's not entirely absentee. It's typically semi-absentee, but that could be as few as 10 to 15 hours of work a week, really, if you're able to find the right general manager to help run the business. So I find that most of my clients, especially those with a day job, those that are doing real estate investing, are tight on time, and a lot of them are looking for those opportunities that they can do on the side, essentially a side hustle. On the economic side, when I give talks to investors, I find that the light bulb oftentimes goes off on what it means to buy into a business. As your listeners know, you know, owning a business, you are able to write off certain expenses that you couldn't, you know, if you just had a corporate job. So that's one piece of it. But beyond just the cash flow year in, year out, you're also building an asset just like you are in real estate that's going to have a residual exit value down the road. That should be a multiple of what you paid for it in the beginning. So you're not just buying a job, you are building an asset. And when we look at the margins out there, oftentimes these opportunities are carrying EBITDA operating margins of north of 20%. You know, not all of them, but you certainly have quite a few that are north of 20%. And that is on revenue. Now, when you look at what your initial investment is and you extract and do the math behind that return on your initial investment, I mean, you're talking significant percentages, which, you know, definitely I'd say in some cases rivaled the returns you can get on real estate. So it's a great way to diversify the portfolio. You know, with my clients, you know, they recognize that right now the stock market, you know, is at an all-time high. It was actually at a new record this morning. Interest rates are low. It's a great time to be in real estate and diversify some of your money there. But there's also only so many good real estate deals to be had at times. And some people are saying, hey, how do we complement and maybe create a new asset class within our portfolio? And that's where they're turning to franchising.
Yeah. And I think like personally where I'm at and why I was also so excited about this is we do a volume of deals. I think we're at 185 closed for the year, something like that. And we have a large team and like a good opportunity going. And then I look at some of the rental properties I've bought and they've gone up in value, but like the cash flow that they're actually spitting off is, like I kind of alluded to at the beginning of our episode here, it's not moving the needle the same way. And I have kind of a mastermind I'm a part of with some M&A guys, and their thing is like buying businesses, selling businesses somewhere in the $1 to $5 or even $10 million range. And they're talking about, 20% return on that $1 million purchase price, maybe even 25% return on that purchase price. And it's like, you're going to put $100,000 to $200,000 down on that million-dollar business. But if it were able to run and throw off that, 20%, we're talking what, like $200,000 a year, like positive? Like that is not going to be, I mean, even with the debt service, I don't know, whatever it is, $8,000, $9,000, it's still talking about probably $100,000 plus in free cash flow at the end of the day. So I guess what I'm saying in a long roundabout way is there seems to be some higher ROI, maybe not quite as absentee as real estate opportunities for people who start off in our business, flipping houses, holding rental property, doing some refinances for cash, but then getting into some things that are, we're doing one deal, let's say, I'm not saying a deal of mine, but that $1 million example, where that one deal we put together throws off $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a month. That's really moving the needle versus a $1 million, apartment building that I might buy where I put the same amount of money down. I have a little bit of a more hands-off experience there, but I'm probably lucky to get $25,000, $35,000 at the end of the year after all the expenses. And it's doing its work for a lot of other reasons. It still makes sense to buy that deal. But it's certainly not going to be the needle moving kind of a thing where a business is perhaps. So let's talk buying into existing businesses, or, you know, I guess we could take it down the avenue, which is probably you're more familiar with, John. But like, what are the pros and cons of buying into a business in the form of like a franchise versus starting a company from scratch?
Yeah. You know, first I'll say franchising is not for everyone. You know, it's definitely an avenue for many, but it's not for everyone. I have some clients that I have to explain you're too entrepreneurial. You want to put your thumbprints all over this entity and maybe go outside the lines. And you know, most franchisors will allow you to, you know, inject your personality into the business, but you know, you still have to stay within the guardrails. But I find that so many of my clients do say, hey, I love the idea of not having to reinvent the wheel. I love that, you know, with the franchise, you know, I essentially get a coach on the sidelines, you know, that franchisor who's cheering me on, who's coaching me, has that aligned interest. I love that there's a playbook. You know, this has been proven out in other markets. It's great to have other franchisees, you know, kind of colleagues around the country that, again, are aligned with my interests. The better I do, the more I represent the brand, the more their locations are worth. And then finally, you know, from an exit standpoint, the Rinker School of Business recently came out with a study. They looked over 2,000 companies over the past 10 years and looked at their exits in comparable industries across a wide range of industries. They looked at franchised and non-franchised. And what they found is the franchise businesses traded at a multiple of 1.5 times the non-franchised, which, you know, I knew it was higher, but a lot of benefits is a sure thing, even with a proven model. You know, you're still going in, you're incurring some level of risk as you are with any venture. However, getting to go in and review the item 19 of the FDD, which is the disclosure of how every other franchisee is performing within the franchise system, that's definitely a helpful data point. I've been able to go through what's called validation and talk to other franchisees about their experience and their ramp up. You know, it gives you some really good data points going in. But again, it's not a sure thing. It comes down to your ability to attract talent, to retain and incentivize that talent, and to make tough calls when needed. You know, I think that's the key piece that people are bringing to the table, as well as, you know, referral partners and local market expertise. So, you know, I do think when you're buying into an existing business, a lot of times people say, hey, you know, you could go with the startup route, which, you know, it's pretty risky, just the numbers would say, or you could buy an existing business. You know, that entrepreneurial through acquisition is a really popular theme right now. You know, the downsides there would be you are paying a multiple, you know, typically to get into the business. You know, positives would be there may already be some cash flow, there may be brand awareness, there may be a team in place. Assuming all those things are good things, you know, they could be bad at the same time. So there's not necessarily a right or wrong. There's just different flavors here of business ownership. I will say with a lot of my clients recently that were looking at existing businesses and got excited about them, they have now come around to franchising because they've said, hey, you know, once I pulled back the covers, I realized the books really weren't what they were portrayed to be. You know, I think that's a big challenge a lot of times when buying into an existing business is really understanding, you know, if the books were well kept and what is kind of hidden under the covers.
Yeah, it makes sense. And as you talk it through, I think of like my own Diamond Equity Investments, our company, and we have our Atlanta location, our Chicago location, our Philadelphia location. And these are kind of set up, although we're not like franchises. There's like a specific partner of mine who's in each of those three businesses who's like operating individually of the other, with me kind of being, you know, at the center stage of this whole thing, if you will. And some of these very valuable yet maybe intangible benefits that, as you're talking about franchising, would probably exist more in the franchise world would be the brand recognition. So we're in these three markets. We're this kind of like larger company. So we have that, you know, where one market is boosting the brand, so is that helping the other? Google reviews, testimonial videos, whatever the case is. But then we also have that same thing, this camaraderie. So a lot of businesses, business owners who are like a one location, one area kind of a thing, it can be very hard. Like who are you going to like kind of like network with, talk to? If your interests aren't aligned, you're not going to like go to like the trade association that's in that location, like share all the best things with your competitors. So there becomes this you know, leveraging of common collective wisdom that occurs for our company. And that's probably one of the biggest things that we have. So the culture that we have is fun to be a part of for people on my team. We're about growth. We're setting goals. We're, you know, boosting each other up. We're high-fiving. We're catching one guy when one guy's going through a slump very quickly, as opposed to like the guy who's operating all in a vacuum trying to do all that himself. It's more fun when there's a little crowd of people there. And then we haven't, you know, really talked like exit plans and things of that nature. But if I'm in the franchise model, like if I looked at my own, perhaps that's, you know, kind of the same way. The best maybe ideal partner, or I'm sorry, buyer maybe at some future point is going to be someone who's already kind of knows the business model. Maybe one of those other franchise location owners, because they're like experienced in the business. They understand the books. They understand the business model. They're aware of the brand. They've already bought into the value. And so maybe the future is being able to exit from this like proven system and sell your share or piece of the brand, which kind of leads me to like the next layer. You had mentioned that you're putting together this portfolio, John. So, you know, there's probably some people who would call you up and we're done our podcast. Say, John, yeah, I like it. You know, I want to get into the pool cleaning or this or that. And then there's probably some people who are all about scale in the business. And you mentioned portfolio and their ears are perked up and they're thinking, OK, so I get into one and now I buy 20. And, you know, I've heard rumors of people who have Yum Brands, for example, large collection of a large number of restaurants in franchises. And I would assume they're buying different franchisees out as they're retiring and moving on and things of that nature. Can you paint the vision for what a portfolio of franchisee or franchises might look like for someone who's looking for, you know, not just the first step, but what does this look like and the real magnitude and size and scale of the opportunity if we're looking at this more like a portfolio type of first step investment, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's a very, I think that's a great question. And a lot of people are thinking that way right now around the country. I've got many clients that are starting to build that portfolio. And you know, I think a great example would be a client of mine, Nathan, over in South Carolina, that he became the largest franchisee of two men in a truck. So he got in, started his own location, started buying other locations. He operates in, I believe, 12 markets now throughout the Southeast. And then, so he's built up a team, a strong operational team. And so in his case, whereas in Atlanta, what we're doing with our portfolio is we're building a portfolio of complementary brands where we get the economies of scale of shared services on the back end, and we get the referrals and cross-selling on the front end. He's going at it a little different route where he's saying, hey, let's create a diversified portfolio of franchise brands. So last year, he and I did a deal for a business. It's a truck with a big old crane arm on the back, and it goes up to roll off dumpsters and rolls back and forth to smash down the debris in the dumpster to about one quarter of the original size, thus saving 3 out of 4 trips to the landfill for that end user. Yeah, there's some innovative concepts like that one. So he bought into that one, 3 territories, has since come back and bought a fourth. Last year, he and I did a deal on a driveway repair business that has a lot of great uniques about it that I'm personally invested in myself on the side. So anyway, he bought into that. He's had great success over the past 6 months. He's now come back and said, hey, I want to buy the whole state of South Carolina. What will that take? So, you know, I love success stories like that. And that's definitely the case for most of my clients. But no, I'd say those are two different approaches. One is, you know, the diversified strategy. One is more of the complementary strategy. You know, and sometimes, you know, I'm going to deal with a client right now where he's buying into his first franchise brand, but he already has several businesses that he started outside of franchising. But as I mentioned, you know, I do think real estate investors, the majority of my clients are real estate investors because they understand, hey, I want to be outside just the markets, you know, for my returns. And what they see is just an opportunity to go out there and do things better in some of these spaces like property management. It could be everything from a property management company to the ServPro type model of the world. It could be a roofing business, a kitchen remodeling business, pool cleaning business. I've done a couple of mosquito deals in the last couple of months with real estate investors. You know, a lot of times they already have those multifamily relationships, or they have a portfolio of single family homes. And even if they don't, if that's where their interest lies, it complements it so well. So no, very, very relevant. I got on the Bigger Pockets podcast. I think we've done 6 deals with their, you know, some of their listeners just in the past 4 or 5 months since I've been on that show. So yeah, lots of interest from the real estate community in franchising is what I'm seeing.
Yeah, real estate investors have a little bit of cash to play with, I imagine. What is the financing structure? I mean, how does a guy like Nathan, you know, maybe like where do you start? You don't have to share all of those particulars, but how are these next steps happening? Is it all from cash flow? Is he bringing in investors on each step of the way? Because I think, you know, listeners are going to want to construct in their mind how they're going to take down something like this.
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, let me just kind of, I think about franchise businesses in 4 different quadrants. You've got simple retail, complex retail, B2C services, and B2B services. I want to get too granular on the categories within those now, but to get at your question, you know, if you're doing a brick and mortar location, a retail type build out, your costs are going to be higher than if you're doing a service-based business that doesn't require a physical location, at least not a customer-facing one. So I'd say the range, all in franchise fee, build out cost, initial marketing cost, initial working capital, it's what we call the item 7 of the FDD. And it's given as a range by the franchisor. If you're doing a retail type space, you're probably somewhere between 150, probably 200,000 up to, let's call it 600,000 or 700,000, with quite a few deals happening in the $300,000 range. If you're doing more of a service-based businesses, like some of the property services ones I just described, you could be in for one location as low as $100,000. I'd say the majority of the deals I do, people buy 3 territories or 3 locations, typically in that 200 to 250 range is kind of the sweet spot that I'm seeing from an all-in investment standpoint. The way people go about making that investment, one, obviously cash or friends and family. I mean, that's always nice, but people are leveraging SBA loans quite often, either the SBA Express loan, typically 150,000 and below, or the SBA 7A loan. In addition, for those, you know, that have built up some retirement assets, they use what's called the ROBS program. And we work with some great providers that really help clients through this process. And with the ROBS program, you're essentially leveraging your 401k or traditional IRA to fund the business. You have to set up as a C corp. You have to jump through a few hurdles, but that is a very common way to fund the business without any tax implications if you structure it a certain way. And then lastly, I'd say...
Is that one there, John? The IRA one? That's kind of interesting. I know a lot of people are going to resonate with that.
Yeah.
So is that treated like a rollover? Is that like taking a loan from the IRA? Would you mind just going in slightly granular there?
Yeah, it's a little more of a rollover type setup where you know, you don't have to pay the penalty for an early withdrawal. Instead of investing, let's say, in stock, you're now invested in the business. And so it does require another level of reporting and kind of upkeep. You have to establish yourself as a C corp. You know, Fran Fund is an organization that most of my clients work with when they do that program, and they take you through, you know, the ins and outs, but then they also stay on top of that ongoing maintenance, and you pay them a monthly, I think it's a monthly fee, to kind of orchestrate that. So that's common. One other thing that might be of interest is a non-retirement brokerage account, loan. And so I've got a great partner up in Charlotte, North Carolina that, we'll do what's called this portfolio loan, where essentially your assets are your security positions. First, with the ROBs are having to liquidate positions. With a portfolio loan, you can keep those positions in place and you're just borrowing against those up to 70% of their value. So let's say you had 200,000 in a brokerage account, you could borrow up to 140,000, functioning as a credit line. So it's not that you have to take it as one lump sum, but you can take it as you need it. And right now, based on where LIBOR is, I mean, you can get that as low as 2 to 4%, which is free money.
Gotcha. Does the IRA own the business? I mean, if you do the exit 10 years out, it goes back into your IRA. Is that kind of how it?
Yeah, great question, Dan. I don't want to speak out of turn on that as far as what the exit looks like. I'm not 100% sure. Fran Fund can definitely guide you through that. My understanding is, yes, the IRA does own it. How that gets treated at the time of the exit, I believe, again, you're not getting penalized for the retirement. You know, you're probably paying tax on it, but you're not taking any tax penalty, you know, essentially for the early withdrawal that you previously took. So you're able to leverage those funds just in a different way. But yeah, I don't want to speak out of turn and around the exit piece on that.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So let's dive into one of the, you know, let's go with a real example, something that If someone is listening right now, they could pick up the phone when we're done the episode and they're like, John, I want in on that one. Cost to get in, you know, size of the opportunity, scope. Let's go through like the exact details as if I were a client of yours looking for a business like right now.
Absolutely. Gosh, that's fun. Which one should I go with?
The best one, I hope.
The best one. How about this? I get excited when I start talking about this specific opportunities. Just did a deal, a placement with a client, is a couple up in New Jersey, in Marlboro, New Jersey. And, they were a previous business owner, owned a printing company. And they had heard me, I think it was on the Entrepreneurs on Fire podcast or something similar. And it sought me out and said, hey, we're interested in business ownership. We want to explore franchising. And so I took them through a process where, I got to know them, had a couple of calls, asked them a lot of questions to help fill in some of the blanks of their understanding of franchising. And then ultimately I did some research on the back end and working with the franchisors. I represent about 300 franchise systems. And narrowed down the opportunities that are available in their area that match their criteria. And we walked through probably 6 or 7 opportunities, looked at the websites. I gave them all the color on the back end of the business, a lot of anecdotal feedback based on my relationships with these franchisors. And then we narrowed it down to 3 opportunities for them to take a next step with, where I made the introduction on their behalf to the franchise systems. They then had what's called a unit economics call. They did a territory review. They did the FTD review. They went through the franchisor's process. And ultimately they said, hey, this is the one that, and I think they dropped 1 or 2 and then we added in 1 or 2 more for consideration. They ultimately went with a brand that it's a Surf Pro type business, water mitigation, mold remediation, $17 billion industry. It's really a B2B play because you're working with landlords and property managers and, insurance brokers. Those are who you're calling on. But they got really excited about the business, about the growth. This business just hit 100 territories nationally. It's been on a nice growth trajectory in recent months. It all checked out. They spent time down in South Florida where the franchisor is based at what's called a discovery day, formed that relationship, got to know each other, said this is the right fit. Meanwhile, I'd had them working with the franchise attorney to do a review of the FDD on their behalf. They also had applied through the SBA, through Fran Fund, for an SBA loan. They did an SBA Express loan. So they kind of did that in conjunction as they're going through the process. They then paid the franchise fee of $49,000 for the one territory out of pocket. And they're waiting on the SBA loan now to come back. They got pre-approved, but the funding always takes a little while to hit. So the funding will hit their account, reimburse them, pay for additional cost of starting the business. All in investment on this business, you're in the ballpark of 120 to 150 if you do one territory. Territories being defined by population or number of addressable households or addressable businesses. Everyone defines it a little bit differently. They plan to buy additional territories over time. And then as far as the item 19 goes of what the financial representation is, it's based on the corporate location down in Naples, Florida. They have been in business for 7 years. The item 19 is $4.1 million top line revenue annually with $1.3 million dropping to the bottom line. I always tell my clients, hey, when we see those types of returns and it's based on the corporate location, let's go very conservative in our analysis as we build out a pro forma. But obviously in a case like this, even if they do 1/3 as well as the corporate location, there's still a lot of meat on the bone. It's an attractive investment. Through the process, they were getting to talk to other franchisees, hear about their experience, their ramp up period, and really help inform their decision-making as they went through it. So, the business, was founded by a great guy. He'd built up another company, HVAC and plumbing business, to eventually had an exit to a Fortune 100 company, took all that experience into this one. Saw an opportunity. It's a $17 billion market, a lot of share to go around. And so that's an example of one that's been on a great run and how I took the client.
So $4.1 million, did you say the corporate ended up with, like, what was the profit for corporate on that example?
Yeah, 1.3.
Okay, so 1.3 million in the end, which is, I don't know, 30% almost on that one?
Give or take 30%, yeah.
Okay. And what type of active owner is going to be required here? I mean, you know, you're spending $120,000 to $150,000 on what exactly? And then what role will these owners play during the ramp up period, time, commitment, till they kind of get that thing on its feet?
Yeah, in their case, they are going to run it owner operator. So they'll go full time managing the team. They won't be out there doing the work, but they'll be overseeing the team. They'll be out there in the Chamber of Commerce and, you know, in the business community, building those networking partners with landlords, property managers, insurance companies. I do have another client that's in the process right now for that same brand that will be managing it as a semi-absentee. And so what he has done is he's found a general manager that will be essentially acting as the owner. And then he will have touch bases with the general manager throughout the week.
What kind of a salary does he pay the general manager? Do you know?
Yeah, I believe it was $60,000 and then a pretty healthy incentive program around profitability. So aligning their interests both on the top line as well as on the bottom line, you know, with the expenses. If the guy's able to run a job with two people instead of three people, you know, you want them thinking like an owner. So I believe there's a quarterly profit sharing program with the goal of getting them into six figures, probably a little north of 100.
Yeah, I know people are going to be thinking about that. How do I scale this, leverage it out? I mean, you find an old ServPro guy with all the contacts already, kind of like got like a plug and play, but you probably got to give him a little more incentive to come on over to your thing.
Yeah, and you know, most positions out there for someone like that, you don't have to have background in it. The franchisor helps in that training process. And so if you want to send your key personnel to the franchisor, they can go through a week of training, usually at no cost. And one thing I would mention too is, as I take clients through the process, there's absolutely no cost to the client. I get paid by the franchisor on the back end, and none of that gets passed on to my clients. You know, the franchise fee is the franchise fee. So it's strictly a sales and marketing expense for the franchisor. None of that gets passed on to my clients.
What kind of a down payment was needed for this example we went through on the SBA loan? And is it unusual right now because we're still in the middle of the, COVID subsidies? Or is that pretty much going to be the going thing no matter if someone calls, you know, now, 6 months or a year from now?
Yeah, no, I mean, right now the government is very eager, to create jobs, to start new businesses. And so they have been very generous in their SBA policies. However, we were doing a lot of SBA loans prior to COVID as well. So I expect that to continue. But typically you're in the 20 to 30% range from a down payment standpoint, just depending on your background and financial situation. So in their case, I think the loan was for 150. And so it would have been, let's call it 25% of that. You're in ballpark right there of, you know, probably around 40,000 or so. They did pay for the franchise fee out of pocket to secure that territory because territories were going fast for that brand. And so they paid that while they were, and then the SBA will reimburse them, but they've been pre-approved. So there was nothing to be concerned with on the funding side.
Gotcha. Let's talk absentee or minimal owner activity. What would be the 1, 2, or 3 segments or business models, perhaps? Maybe we sort of covered it with hiring the GM, but can you, if that were something high on my list, which franchises or segments would I want to consider?
Yeah, you know, it varies. It varies. I mean, that's the answer. It's, you know, I've got a client right now. Here's another real world example that he's in the process of buying 9 locations in Atlanta and Charlotte of an oil change business. This oil change business is entirely semi-absentee. Typically, it's staffed by 2 people at a location. What they do is they go about it a little bit differently. They use unused parking spaces in retail shopping centers. So you've it creates an additional revenue stream for the landlord. You've got great traffic visibility, built-in traffic as well. Typically 8 unused parking spaces for a 1-bay location. It's a prefabricated building backed by an investor group. And so you're literally leasing the building from them. They're handling the sewage hookup, the pit dig out and everything. But you know, my client, he's not going to be involved in the business. He is putting a manager over each of the 3 locations, and that manager will work in the business in 1 of the locations while overseeing an additional 2 locations. And then I don't know the exact pay scale that he's paying them, but it's definitely aligned to a profit sharing type program. And so, yeah, it's something that he's really excited about, but he owns a property management company. He owns a flooring company that both do very well. And he said, hey, you know, I've got some excess cash. I'd like to diversify my portfolio. Fell in love with this opportunity. So that's a real world example. But as far as outside of that, you know, I'd say health and wellness, you know, kind of the fitness space, you know, it can be crowded at times, but there are categories within that maybe that cater to the senior population where, you know, you're not having to be in there day in, day out. So a lot of these property services businesses, you know, also cater to that. You know, there's a great gutter business right now. There's a great insulation business, both of which can be run semi-absentee, but you have to have the right general manager in place. And so I think that is the key is, will someone be able to find that general manager? You know, someone that they trust, someone that they can incentivize. And if so, that general manager can act in their place as in the owner, even if they don't have equity.
Got it. So we are in the middle of probably a historic labor shortage and nobody can hire anyone to do anything. I'm curious how many locations you might have in the portfolio already to kind of give us some framework on if you're currently experiencing labor shortages that a lot of people are talking about here on the news, or maybe you're kind of immune to that, or maybe these franchises have such a robust marketing system to get labor in the door to kind of help hire these general managers and obviously the workforce that is at every level in the company. What is the solution, if any, or just the feedback of the general labor market from your perspective in the franchise world?
Yeah. You know, I'd say the labor market is very similar to non-franchise. It's tough right now. You know, and as a business owner, you're playing whack-a-mole. And, you know, right now the mole is on the labor side. You know, there's huge customer demand really across industries. I mean, and we're seeing that with our own businesses. But the challenge is, you know, finding people and finding the right people and keeping them. It was something that we did in our some of our services businesses with my partners. We had to implement a weekly bonus that we pay strictly for hitting all five of your shifts that week. So if you show up every day and you complete your shifts, then we'll give you an extra $7,500.
Wow.
And it ends up, you know, being maybe $2, you know, per hour. The math works on our end because we're also in turn raising our prices. I mean, it's no lie to any of your listeners that we're in an inflationary environment right now. And, you know, the great thing is we are able to raise our prices just like you can raise your rents in real estate. So, you know, we're not necessarily raising it the full amount to offset on the labor side. But, you know, as unemployment gets wound down, you know, things have to change at some point. You know, we probably can't walk back that extra money that we're paying, but what we're going to do is add in the additional criteria for being able to hit that goal. So, you know, in addition to showing up, you also have to, you know, do a couple of additional things on top of that. So, yeah, but no way. Everyone is aware of the labor challenge out there right now. I mean, you can still find good people, but it just takes a little bit more effort to do that. And so a lot of my clients do say, hey, what are those concepts that require the fewest employees to still make a good bang for the buck? That's a very common discussion we're having.
Got it. And what are the industries for something like that fewest employee requirement?
Yeah. You know, again, I shy away from food. I really focus in other sectors, and I'd say food is obviously employee heavy. You know, I mentioned the driveway business. That's an example where you have very little overhead. You have a commissioned salesperson. You have one or two people on the fulfillment side on the back end. You know, within, you know, the oil change business, that's two people per location. Can you staff up to that? We've got a great dumpster business, which, you know, essentially these guys out there driving the truck, another one is doing the sales and marketing. And so I think if you can keep it to a manageable group, and then you're going to end up probably paying a little bit more now than you typically would in this environment, but you can also charge more. So it's just a shift. And really people understand, I mean, when we raise prices in our home cleaning business, we positioned it to our clients that, to our customers, you know, we're doing this. They know what's going on out there. And we're saying, hey, we're having to pay a little bit more to have the best people out there to service you. And they'll gladly pay that. We really didn't lose any meaningful number of customers when we raised prices. They get it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Interesting, the ways to deal with the challenge. Kind of like there's like this incentivization I don't know, maybe this like new trend, John, you know, just like systemically in business and altogether. Like I've typically tried to approach all of my people as business partners, and we kind of have this like business partner split. We do a deal, we all three of us are working on this deal, and we're splitting, you know, the profit or the loss on that deal. And that's kind of how it's shaking out, rather than here's a salary and then all of the upside stays with corporate. Maybe there's this solution, kind of like you're saying, where it's like $2 an hour or the GMs are getting these profit sharing bonuses. I mean, I wonder if there's like some trend toward aligning the incentives at some level, almost at every level of the business, as opposed to just management, executive, and ownership levels there. I mean, just a thought, I guess.
Yeah. You know, I did have a learning a few years ago with the business that I was running where I said, hey, let's do a quarterly profit sharing plan. This was for hourly employees. And in that case, that didn't resonate. 3 months can be a very long time to someone that's living paycheck to paycheck or close to it. And I realized what they used as a comparison between different opportunities in the market was more of that rate per hour. So I had to translate it back to speak their language. Now, on the flip side, we recently hired a GM for one of our businesses, and we offered him three options. I always like to give options. You could take a $90,000 base salary, $80,000 or $70,000. If you take 90, you get 10% of earnings. If you take 80, you get 15%. If you take 70, you get 20%. Guess what he chose? 70 and the 20%. You know, and I always like them when they, when they check that box, it shows they believe in the business. But you definitely have to gear it and speak the language of the individual level.
So is that 90, 80, 70, 10, 15% earnings? Is that an interview question? Is that like a test for you to see, you know, if I'm like all things are equal between two candidates and like one is answering that question a certain way, like that might tip the scale?
Yeah. You know, we didn't ask it to multiple candidates at the same time. So it wasn't a, for a comparison, but no, I totally agree with you. I like it as an interview question. For us, it was really kind of that last step of negotiating the agreement. We'd gone through around several rounds of interviews, but so we probably would have taken them at 90,000 in 10%, but we certainly liked his answer.
Yeah. I mean, it's total fantasy world that we have two well-qualified candidates sitting in front of us. Like, I can't remember when that happened.
Back in the day, that's how it was, right?
Yeah, I guess. I missed that one. So what are the risks, John? How can I lose my money? Why would a market not accept my, my business model? What are some things that could happen that are going to turn this into a bankrupt situation?
Yeah. Well, first off, we want to be wise about what we're investing versus what our current assets are. You know, you don't want to overextend. But if there are comparable markets out there that you can point to and people with similar backgrounds that are buying into the system and they're doing well, it doesn't guarantee your success, but gosh, it certainly increases your likelihood of it. What I tell clients oftentimes is, hey, let's look at the absolute downside. Say, for whatever reason, maybe you get sick once you start the business and realize you can't run it, or just have no interest in it, or it's just not taking off. What is the downside? I mean, typically you can resell that business. If you built it at all, you should be able to sell for at least what you paid for it. But if it just hasn't done well, I mean, maybe you have to take a haircut, but you're still going to have some residual value for that business based on that franchise system that someone out there is going to be willing to pay. And it may be a neighboring franchisee. It could be, if you're in East Chicago, it could be that Northern Chicago franchise owner that says, hey, I'd love to expand and I'm kind of landlocked right now. But if you want to give it to me and maybe take a haircut on it, then, in most cases, there's minimal downside. Your risk of losing everything is fairly minimal. But again, if you go out and you open 10 brick and mortar locations, you have a massive capital investment and you're highly leveraged and, it's not a proven brand, you would incur a little more risk.
Yeah. And I think it's probably smart. I mean, I think I shopped for franchises one time in a magazine that I bought somewhere, which Franchise Monthly or whatever it was. And I remember like kind of paging through it. Maybe it was like Entrepreneur magazine or something in the back. Yeah. And it was like, I cringe now having the conversation with you who has more experience in shopping for franchises, being in the seat that you're in. And I cringe at the thought of people responding to an ad in the back of that magazine. And like, that's the extent of how they're shopping for these, franchises is by this, very top level, probably not in depth, limited amount of experience with all these different brands, and probably assuming very limited ability to analyze the risk and analyze the pros and cons of specific franchises just by the nature of them, you know, digging in and to an ad they found in a magazine. So that would also be a risk, right?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately there's 4,000 franchise brands out there in the US. If we, what we have done is we have vetted them, taken them down to a portfolio of 300 that we have chosen to represent. And at times we'll drop some and bring others in. And then, you know, I really go deep with, you know, the ones that I would buy into myself and pick out. You know, I'd say there's probably a list of 50 that I really know, like the back of my hand, that that, you know, I was down in Florida with 150 franchisors 2 weeks ago. They were all sharing with me what's going on the back side, you know, what they have coming up. I mean, we do this every 6 months. And, you know, I'm constantly deciding, you know, hey, these are my top 10 that, you know, that I want my clients, you know, getting into. And, you know, I think for me being able to put myself in my client's shoes, because I mean, I'm a franchisee, I'm a former franchisor, and I'm used to being in the corporate world and I've invested in real estate. You know, I know what it looks like the day to day for them. And I just love having those conversations and helping guide them through the process, because it can be overwhelming, not knowing where to start. And once you really understand what's going on the backside, you can really get excited about the right opportunities.
Yeah, I guess the metaphor, the bridge I'd make with what you're doing and your background and actually owning some of these things is kind of like a real estate agent who actually does flip houses selling you a flip, or a real estate agent who actually does own rental property selling you a rental property investment. In most cases, you're not going to have to come out of pocket to pay that agent. Just like you're representing the company, and the company kind of pays, they got like that listing side is where
exactly
your incentive is. And it's, again, another cringeworthy thing to think like the 23-year-old kid is selling a rental property to someone and it's their first rental. I'm like, oh man, that could be like a really, really dangerous situation. John, any other questions I did not have the insight to ask that you feel like the audience might be thinking?
You know, I think you hit them head on. That was a great discussion. I would be more than happy to chat with any of your listeners. You know, and like I said, entirely free. Would love to jump on let's jump on a 15-minute call, have a discussion, hear a little bit more about your situation. I'd love to fill in some of the knowledge gaps. And then, you know, ultimately, if this is something that you feel serious about, happy to take you through the process. I love playing matchmaker, getting to do what I do, and would love to connect with anyone. Feel free to reach out to me, John, J-O-N, at FranBridgeConsulting.com, or visit us on our website, sign up for our newsletter, connect with me on LinkedIn. I would love to engage.
Nice. Are there any book recommendations you'd have in closing? Could be franchise, could be real estate, or anything else that comes to mind?
Yeah, you know, I've actually got my own franchise book that's in the works, The Franchise Path. It's done. We just have to literally get it out the door. So excited about that. But The Franchise MBA is a great book. I wouldn't overthink it. You know, I think some people overthink things, do a little too much research on the front end. Our whole model is streamlined to make it easy for you. But then one non-franchise book I'd mention is The Compound Effect by Darren Hardy. I've read it multiple times. It's one of my favorites I go back to. My wife lets me pick a book every year for her to read of one of the ones I've read the previous year. And I've had her read it, I think, twice now. But it says little decisions day in, day out that just add up over time. And so anyway, that's one of my favorites, Compound Effect by Darren Hardy.
Nice. So crown jewel of wisdom, John, how long have you been in there? You said, what was it, like 5-10 years, something for the franchise thing?
You know, I've spent most of my career in the corporate world, and I've got into franchising a little over 5 years ago. And it never looked back. I've absolutely fallen in love with space, love helping others kind of achieve their dream, and understand you know, this other path to business ownership.
So if you could go back 5 years ago, you were just leaving corporate America, and you could share the crown jewel of wisdom with yourself at that moment, knowing everything you know now, what would you tell yourself?
You know, back then, I'd say activity breeds activity. Get off the sidelines, get in the game. Don't feel like you have to have it all figured out on day one. If you start moving towards option A or option B, very oftentimes option C comes out of left field. And so that's just been a principle in my life is, you know, once you get in the game, get active, good things happen.
All right, cool. Any other final asks or thoughts as we wrap up?
No, excited about what's going on in franchising. We're seeing massive, massive growth coming out of COVID. And, you know, if someone is thinking about business ownership or diversifying their investments, would love to help you understand, you know, what this path looks like.
All right. Sounds good. Hey, thank you, John, for coming on the show. Had a blast. Got a ton of value and notes myself. So I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Enjoyed the discussion.
Thank you for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Remember to review and subscribe on your podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. Are you interested in receiving my weekly Big Idea email, where I provide the most valuable jewel of wisdom that I discovered during the recording of the most recent episode? You can sign up at reidiamonds.com. And at that site, you can also access the 197 episode archive organized by category. Again, that's reidiamonds.com. So last year, 2020, my house flipping business, Diamond Equity Investments, bought and sold 283 houses. So far, we've done 225 this year. Well, mostly houses, a few were apartment buildings, and we currently have about 146 more in our inventory, either under construction or awaiting settlement. We are growing. So here are three ways that you and I can do business. Number one, if you are interested in having access to the best deals in your market, in other words, access to deals that you can buy at low enough prices to actually make a profit after renovating and reselling, go now to www.accessrealestatedeals.com. Number two, accredited investors seeking double-digit returns can sign up for my private mortgage investment opportunity emails at www.fundrehabdeals.com. That would be investing exclusively in my own deals. I don't do any third-party brokering of these loans and deals. Number three, if you are interested in joining the Diamond Equity Investments team, you can review the current positions we have available by clicking on the careers link at dealswithroi.com. We are at the conclusion, my friend. Next up, we have Victor Yurachek joining us to discuss his start in flipping houses in 2018 and then quickly ramping up to doing 20 to 30 flips per year since then. So I'll catch you and Victor next time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.